Greetings, I'm Austin Egbert, director of Mind Matters News. Welcome to another BingeCast, where multiple episodes are fused into a single program. This BingeCast features Larry L. Linenschmidt of the Hill Country Institute in an interview with Jay Richards about his book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. This interview was originally aired by the Hill Country Institute at their website, hillcountryinstitute.org, and is included here with permission in its entirety. Enjoy.
Welcome to Hill Country Institute Live, the program that brings you together with Christian leaders, authors, and pastors to discuss major issues of our time. We seek to encourage and equip followers of Jesus Christ to show His heart and mind in all that we do. I'm Larry Linenschmidt, your host, and I thank you for joining us today. We have a special program with a Christian thought leader, author, and professor who has written on the issues of faith and work and the concern of how we cope with technological advances, particularly artificial intelligence. Stay with us. You want to hear more about virtue in business, how humans have benefited from technological advances in history, and particularly how we will be impacted and benefit from artificial intelligence. We invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to hear podcasts of our past radio programs on topics including faith and work, science and art, fighting human trafficking, the spiritual formation of C.S. Lewis, and much more. We've had many interesting guests, including Oz Guinness, Dan Davis, and Andy Crouch, and others. The website also offers audio and video from our past conferences and seminars on faith and science and other topics. And our radio programs are also available on podcast as Hill Country Institute Live. The program is supported by donations, and you can donate to support this program at hillcountryinstitute.org. For donations over $100, you have your choice of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines by our guest, Jay Richards, or another book on specific aspects of faith and culture. Contact us at 512-680-7993 for additional information. Visit hillcountryinstitute.org to donate, and please contact us if you would like to sponsor this program. Our guest today, Jay Richards, is the author of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. He earned his Ph.D. in philosophy and theology from Princeton, is a research professor at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America, and is an executive editor of The Stream, which features articles on faith, work, and many other cultural topics. Now, let's welcome our special guest, Jay Richards. Jay, thank you for being with us today. Welcome to Hill Country Institute Live.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. I'd like for our audience to get to know you a little bit personally. Tell us about your family. You mentioned them in your book.
Yeah, I do, actually. And so I'm married and live now, actually, in Washington, D.C. I have two daughters. One is 19 and one is 15. My 19-year-old, we're actually a homeschooling family. So our 15-year-old, though she's in high school, is homeschooled. And which really, in this part of the country, we call it drive school, because you're involved in co-ops and all sorts of different things.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You're not literally in the house all day. And then my 19-year-old, Jillian, is actually a sophomore at Catholic University, where I'm on the faculty. And we actually live in a townhouse just about 200 yards from the campus here in Washington, D.C., which is really nice. But I was for many years full-time at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. And so my daughters still sort of feel and think of themselves as Seattleites. But we've lived in the Washington, D.C. area now for over 5.5 years.
Well, that's two of the most interesting places to live in the country, I would think.
Yeah, one is beautiful, one is interesting. But, you know, when we first moved to Washington, D.C., lived in suburban Virginia at the time, from Seattle, it did take some getting used to. That's the problem with living in Seattle, is it's so beautiful that almost any place that you move is, you know, kind of a downgrade in terms of natural beauty. But Washington, D.C. is great because there's just so much happening. And so, you know, I felt like in some ways we were sort of bound to end up here at some point, and that's what happened.
Well, and being on the edge of the campus, you're just part of that whole environment, the academic environment, the people who come to speak. It's got to be very rich for your family.
It really is. I mean, and that's the funny thing that you don't necessarily think about, but because, you know, for good or for ill, Washington, D.C. is the center of political power on on planet Earth, essentially. And so there are people coming through here constantly. So that when I first moved here, honestly, Larry, I mean, Seattle's a great place, but it's not like there are 20 really important events, mm-hmm. all of which you feel like you need to be attending happening simultaneously. That's how Washington, D.C. is. There's always several things. When I got here for a few months, I sort of was at anxiety because I felt like, oh, I'm missing this very important meeting, or I'm missing this briefing or this lecture. And you eventually just get used to it and have to decide, okay, what great things am I going to miss today so that I can prioritize something else?
Sure. Well, we have probably a lesser standard of that here in Austin with the state capitol and being a tech center. Mm-hmm. And there's literally always something literally almost every day, something you could go see. And it's a little bit disruptive with traffic and everything. But, being in Washington and thinking about business and economics, you're a professor at the Bush School of Business there at the university. Mm-hmm. And you've got this great policy statement. In Washington, D.C., the center of business policy, we are unleashing virtue-based free enterprise to lift the human person and transform the culture. I mean, everybody I know that's working on faith in business just can resonate with that statement. It's wonderful.
It really is, and it's really exciting to be at a business school that has anchored that, this virtue-based approach to free enterprise, into our mission statement. I mean, there's always been a department of business at CUA, but the Bush Business School itself is only about 6 years old. And to just be able to sort of start from the ground up with that kind of thinking, it is exciting. And it's exciting to be able to do it in a Christian context and to be able to do it in Washington, D.C., because we're convinced that, for good or for ill, the primary way in which value and wealth is created and poverty is alleviated in the world that God actually created is by way of business. And we're so often used to either thinking of it as just a kind of cutthroat dog-eat-dog enterprise or as just a necessary evil. But we, in fact, think that, yes, the world has fallen, but there is a redeemed way of doing work. And, in fact, we think that work is actually a part of our call as human beings. In fact, it precedes the fall. It's not, we don't just work because we're fallen and there's scarcity and we need to eat. We work because we're created in the image of the creative God, and God wants us, in a sense, to participate in the creative activity of, he creates a world and then he leaves the world in a certain state. It's not, hasn't done everything that it could do, and then he leaves it to us to be able to do things with the created order that weren't there before. And so we think it's actually a part of our calling as human beings to work and to create value.
Sure. Well, and there was work even before the fall. I think that when you look at work as a curse versus work as a blessing, as a part of our DNA, then you really need to go back to the pre-fall time in Scripture. So that is that's
you
all.
Do.
Yeah,
it's there. I mean, this is something that every Christian, that's at all well catechized has read those first two chapters of Genesis. But it's easy to think that the fall itself is what caused work, because then Adam was cursed to work and toil. But work is toil in which your work, there's a kind of futility to it because the earth won't sort of do what you want it to do. That's one thing. But, God created man and woman, created Adam and Eve, put them in the garden, and then commanded them to be fruitful and multiply and to till and to keep the garden. That happened before the fall. So, yes, God set up a garden at the beginning, but he told them, you need to till it and to keep it. That's work, and that was a part of the creation mandate before the fall ever happened. And it's really important, I think, for Christians to always remember that.
Sure. It's essential. Well, in your book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in the Age of Smart Machines, one of your key ideas is, going back to farming, is how we have technologically improved how we do things. And in farming, we've made tools better from an early state. We invented fire. We had a printing press. And so technology has changed many, many times, and it's generally helped to create jobs. So how does this technological change and creation of jobs and adapting fit into your thinking?
Well, the book is in part written as a response to this kind of hysteria that we're about to have permanent so-called technological unemployment. In other words, artificial intelligence and robotics, they're not just going to enhance our labor, they're going to actually replace not only our labor, but replace us. So that, there are lots of experts saying that humans are essentially going to be obsolete in the future because machines are going to do everything. And I think it's deeply misguided. I think it's a misinterpretation of technology. Of course, I can't prove what the future jobs are going to be because they don't exist yet. And so that's why I spend a lot of time in history saying, look, anybody, you could make this argument for permanent technological unemployment at any stage of technological development. The first time somebody figured out to hit two flint rocks together to start a controlled fire, they were, in a sense, you know, commandeering the forces of nature to do something they wouldn't do on their own for a purpose. The first time somebody used a shovel, they made an old way of digging obsolete. And so any time we develop a technology that enhances our labor, we're making an old type of work, an old way of working. You think of that as an old job, obsolete. But it doesn't mean that leaves us with nothing to do. It just, what it does is it changes the market. And so I think the strongest example of this would be the shift from the agrarian stage of the economy and actually of the American dream to the industrial stage. In the time of the American founding in 1776, 95% of the population was living and working on farms. Today, it's way less than 2%. In fact, it's almost 1% of the population. Now, if you were to be told that ahead of time, you might have thought, oh, my word, you know, 94% of the human or the American population is going to be unemployed in the future. Well, of course, that's not all what happened. Yes, there was disruption in which people's ways of life changed, but new and actually better jobs emerged as the price of food and the cost for producing food goes way down. Suddenly, people's labor is freed up for doing other things, and people's constant ingenuity, we find new things to do and new ways to create value. And so I just don't think that, yes, even though artificial intelligence and robotics are going to be hugely disruptive, there is no reason to believe that if we don't adapt ourselves, the future can't also be bright. And so that's really the challenge of the book, is to say, look, do not think that high technology, just because it's different from other types of technology, is going to make humans obsolete. It's just not true.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll get back more to what we're seeing and what's happening and some of the doomsday kind of predictions from people like Hawkins and Bill Gates and others. But mm-hmm. one of the things you develop in the book is this connection of virtue and how we do business. And you're not dealing with the seven virtues, you know, prudence and faith and hope and mm-hmm. charity and the things we usually think about, but you have some other virtues. So when you think about virtue in the world of exchange, where we have business and company formation and trade and jobs, what's the connection there? How does virtue work? How does virtue play itself out?
Yeah. Well, it's two things. One is that the ability to develop virtue. So virtue is essentially a positive thing you can develop about yourself based upon repeated, habitual, intentional action. So if you want to be a punctual person, get up on time and show up on time. You do that enough. At first it's hard, then it becomes a habit, and then eventually if you keep at it and have focused attention on it, it becomes a part of who you are. And since you kind of reprogram yourself to be more than you were at the beginning, that's virtue. And I argue that, in fact, the key thing that distinguishes man from machine is the fact that we exercise freedom, we're conscious agents that can act for purposes, we can develop virtue. Unless we're free and conscious and are intelligent agents, we can't do that. And so in many ways, virtue is one of the things that distinguishes us from machines. And so then the question I realized is, okay, so what's the information economy like? What are the key features of the new economy that's now emerging? And then what would be the virtues that would best help us to be able to adapt and to prosper and to flourish in that economy? And so in the book, I work out really what I call the five features of the information economy, one of which is that I've already mentioned, it's highly disruptive. Things change very quickly. Certain ways of doing things become obsolete very quickly. The corresponding virtue to that is courage. Courage is the virtue in which you're willing to act even in the context of possible failure. And that's absolutely, that's a crucial virtue because things change so quickly that you can't know the future directly. So you've got to be willing to try things, even in the context of failure. And that's courage. That's the willingness to do that. Of course, that's not the only virtue, but that's the first one that I argue that you need. And I go on and build these sort of five virtues. Now, I should say that all the basic virtues, all the spiritual and moral virtues that are traditional are also hugely important. Prudence, for instance, you mentioned, which is seeing the world as it is and acting accordingly. In many ways, these are all a function of prudence. What we wanted to say, what's the world really like? What do I need to do? And how do I need to change myself in order to be able to flourish in it?
Sure. Well, C.S. Lewis just always seems to come to mind, and he said courage is where all the virtues come together, and it's that sense. And one of the things I really enjoyed in reading your book was how you used entrepreneurial examples, people who did something to illustrate that. And Derry do is a pretty descriptive term. I think people would kind of know. But tell us about Brad Morgan. How did he exhibit courage?
Oh, he's probably my favorite story. And as you mentioned, he started out a dairy farmer in sort of central Michigan, but was a small family dairy farm and really was not succeeding at it. And thought, well, you know, I'm spending a bunch of money getting rid of all this manure for my dairy cows. I wonder if I can figure out how to compost it. He knew there was a market for natural fertilizer and compost. And so he hired some consultants who said, oh, yeah, you could do this. But their proposal actually was no way for him to make a profit. And he just, with his own mother wit and familiarity with composting and manure, figured out a new way to compost the manure. In other words, take plain old manure and turn it into compost, which you can use on field, you can use in your gardens, and to do it so quickly that he could actually make a profit. So now he ships in manure every year onto his land and composts it and then sells it. I love this story for several reasons. One, because notice Morgan had to have courage. He started out a dairy farmer that wasn't working, and he ventured out in another place to try compost farming. He actually did things contrary to what some of the official experts said. That was hugely courageous and bold. Also creative. He exercised the virtue of creative freedom because he found a new way literally to turn waste into wealth. I mean, usually when we're talking that way, we're speaking metaphorically. But in this case, he literally takes cow manure and turns it into a really rich, powerful plant food. And so it started out as a low-tech operation, but now when I was, I actually did a documentary in which I told this story about 12 years ago, and in writing this book, I checked in with him again, and I got a high-tech operation with a full-time agronomist on staff and sells everything, almost everything over the internet now and things like this. So it's a great story, a kind of rags-to-riches story. It's a story of entrepreneurial courage and creativity, and it illustrates what successful entrepreneurship is, which is really creating something of values.
Yeah, and another one of your values is altruism. And there's a sense of doing what you call doing unto others as you'd want them to do unto you. And it requires maybe a vision for how something could be. So how is seeing a need and filling it different from maybe the capitalism as greed myth?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most pervasive myth that, capitalism, or that's not my favorite term, but the free enterprise or market economy is really just about greed. It's about people saying, okay, how can I make a buck off of other people? And that you can do that in almost any economy, but that's not actually, if you think about the normal way in which business people and entrepreneurs succeed. If you're a butcher, you could try to sell spoiled meat, but you'd end up with a bunch of one-star ratings on Yelp and go out of business quickly. The best way for a butcher to succeed as a butcher is to provide meat that people want, that they will freely buy at a price that they're willing to pay, and to do it better than his competitors. In other words, for a butcher to succeed, the best thing he can do is think, what do other people need, and what can I do to actually provide it for them at a price they're willing to pay? That's being other-directed. I mean, the word altruism, it doesn't just mean being self-sacrificial. That's a type of altruism, to do something for other people that is at your own expense. Of course, Christ is the prime example of that. He dies for us. That's a type of altruism. But there's also what you might think of as commercial altruism, and that's where you figure out a way to serve other people in a way that also benefits you. And so you interact in a so-called mutually beneficial exchange. So the butcher makes money off of this operation, but he only makes money if somebody's willing to pay him and wants to depart with their money more than and wants the meat more than they want the money, and he's going to need the money more than he needs or wants the meat. That's beneficial on both sides. And so I really want people to think about enterprise and business as one way in which we can serve our fellow human beings, but what makes it unique is we serve our fellow human beings while also benefiting ourselves.
Yeah, and there's kind of an awareness, I have a high view of creativity and I put the arts, but also entrepreneurism and software design. Mm-hmm. You know, all creativity is a huge topic. So an entrepreneur that can see something or perhaps experience something like one of your other examples, Miss to Mrs. It's a great story about a woman's difficulties leading her to form a business to help other people with the same difficulty.
That's right. And Danielle Tate, actually, she lives here in the Washington, D.C. area. And she she wanted to go to medical school. She was a biology major, didn't get into, she ended up applying to the very best medical schools and didn't get into them. And so didn't try any others. But that's a funny part of the story. But for her, it was an abject failure. That's how it felt. And so she did sales in the pharmaceutical industry for a couple of years. And then met a guy and wanted to get married and had to change her name, lived in Maryland. And realized it took her 3 days and three different trips to the DMV in different places just to get her last name changed. And then she thought, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. And her husband said, well, you should find out how to do it. She started studying it, realized, you know, there's a way to do this. We can develop a website, charge a fee, and help other brides-to-be be able to change their names for $30 and in 30 minutes. And she did that. And so it's a perfect example of something that, in her case, once she experienced failure, so she ended up doing something she never would have thought of was as a way to make money and have a career. But then she also had to say, okay, I don't want other people have to have this problem I had. It's really time consuming and frustrating. I want to help future brides to be able to make this to work. And so she's done it, found a price point in which they can actually succeed as a business. And that, you know, a bride, heck, if you can spend 30 minutes and $30, you're nuke the next 3 days getting your name changed, what are you going to do? And so again, it's mutually beneficial. That's altruistic. It showed courage in the context of failure. That's a great entrepreneur. That's a great story of entrepreneurship. I just love it.
Well, it seems that an entrepreneur or someone in sales either has to save somebody money or solve a problem. Everything boils down to that. And she found a way to...
Yeah, to do both. And that solves a problem. And what's funny about it is that I noticed entrepreneur stories often, you hear about the exciting stuff, you know, turning manure into compost or finding a way to help people change their names easily. But the truth of the matter is Danielle Tate had to spend a couple of years reading a lot of boring stuff. She had to find out what are name-changing laws in all 50 states. She had to study the sociology of name-changing. And in some ways, successful entrepreneurs need to be willing to sort of bear a lot of boring and tedious labor in order to, you know, that other people don't have to do it. And so in some ways, you know, very often it's sort of like detective work. We love watching these detective shows on TV when they catch the bad guy. But, you know, a lot of it is looking through phone records and stuff like that. And so, you know, I just think it's clear that the story of entrepreneurship is a story of exercising particular virtues. And I just don't think that's not what people have in mind when they think about enterprise or when they think about business. They think of a tuxedo-clad guy on the Monopoly game or some bad caricature of a business person from literature or from a movie. But that's not the normal way in which enterprise works.
Sure. In a free market, if you have an idea, you may have to do a lot of just behind-the-scenes grunt work to bring it to fruition and make it succeed. I certainly don't envy her figuring out how to get your name changed in 50 states. My gosh.
Oh, it's awful. I know. I'm so glad somebody else did that.
Yeah. We've been talking about virtues. We talked about how the creativity that God's given us was to be his image bearer, to take care of what he created and to add to it and make more of that. And then you bring in the idea so well in the book that there are virtues that we bring into business and into our careers and job creation and company creation. And we've talked about a couple, altruism being one, but keep growing is one of your virtues. We have some idea what that might mean, but what do you think of when you think of keep growing?
Well, I mentioned already, we've talked about the virtue of courage, which is just the willingness to act in the context of failure. But anybody, you know, thinks about this is going to know that failure alone is not the key to success. I mean, you can just keep failing and failing and failing. And so the sort of second virtue I talk about is what I really call anti-fragility, which you can think of that as a growing process. What anti-fragility is kind of like adaptability or resilience, but, you know, adaptability just means that you can adapt and survive in different contexts. Anti-fragility is the virtue in which you actually improve when you have difficulties. And a really basic example of this would just be what we do at our bodies, what organisms do. So if you lift weights, for instance, you know, when you first start lifting weights, if you're doing it right, you're actually tearing muscle fibers, you're creating an inflammatory response in your muscles. But if you do it right, and then you take a break and take rest and eat properly, you will actually build more muscle, more and larger and stronger muscles than you had before. It's not just that your body will repair itself, it will come back stronger than it was before. That's the virtue of anti-fragility. It's so important because on the one hand, you need to be willing to be courageous and to act in the context of failure, but you also need to be able to take failure and learn something from it so that it improves you. And a lot of this is really mindset. If you try something, you try a job, or you start out on a degree that doesn't work out, you can say, well, it's a terrible waste of time, or you can say, okay, what did I learn and what did that give me that I wouldn't have had otherwise that I can use going forward? That's anti-fragility. And anti-fragility, by the way, it's a term from a writer named Nicholas Nassim Taleb, and the book is called Anti-Fragile, where he develops this idea, and he says we tend to think of the opposite of fragility. That is, fragility is just something that's easily broken, and you perturb it and it breaks, you sing a loud pitch and the crystal glass breaks. But the opposite of fragility might just be something like being rigid or robust, but that just means it doesn't break easily and it's strong. That's different. There's really this third thing, anti-fragility, which is not the same as being rigid. It's being flexible and having the capacity to improve, to grow, to get better as the result of damage and perturbation. And that's just as important whether you're working out and training for a triathlon or you want to succeed ultimately in a business enterprise, which has surprises and problems that you can't anticipate ahead of time.
Sure. Well, and I love your examples. Again, fitnessblender.com, something you personally use, came out of a failed situation, didn't it?
It did. That was a married couple named Daniel and Kelly Seegers. In fact, I started the book with them. They had lived up in the Seattle area, north of Seattle, and in 2008 they got married and saved their life savings and bought a house in August of 2008, which was at the very sort of moment of the explosion of financial crisis that was located in the mortgage industry. So they closed on their house on a Friday, and on Monday, Kelly basically had all of her hours slashed, and Daniel, who was a personal fitness trainer, lost almost all of his clients. And so they thought, well, what are we going to do? They had this house, they had a garage, and they had a few hundred dollars worth of video equipment. So they painted the back one wall of the garage white, started making little videos. Now, this was 2008, so this is early on. YouTube wasn't what it is now. And just posting little workout videos on YouTube. It slowly but surely kind of built up a subscriber base. The videos got better and better. They now have, I think at last count, something like 5 million subscribers. In fact, they kept adding a million subscribers while I was writing the book. But these weren't people, they don't have degrees in computer science or in video production or anything, but using the technology that was available to them and a network technology that allows them to train people now everywhere. If you read the comment section at Fitness Blender, you'll see women from Saudi Arabia doing their online exercises, you know, in their homes in Saudi Arabia. I discovered them because I need workouts when I'm on the road traveling, and very often I just have to work out in my hotel room. And they do these great videos that show you exactly what to do without any equipment in your hotel room. And so it's just, you know, it's one story, but I like it because it depends on high technology. It depends on the internet. It depends on easy video production tools. It depends on YouTube. But it's also them really harnessing these really basic skills, which is their knowledge, as it happens, of the fitness industry and being able to train people. But now, rather than training individual clients, they can train hundreds of thousands of people at once.
Well, when you mention the connectivity that they have that's available to them, it leads directly into another value of yours, collaboration. Mm-hmm. And why do you consider collaboration a virtue?
Well, it's a virtue because collaboration is essentially a form of humility. So what collaboration is the willingness and the ability to both learn from others and to work with others. That's always, in many types of work, that's going to be, if you're a team player, that's going to be a virtue. But if you think you're the smartest person in the room and you don't think you have anything to learn from anyone else, you're never going to be a good collaborator. But collaboration is especially important as a virtue now because of the hyperconnectivity of our economy. I mean, if you think about it, until about 150 years ago, the fastest way for one person to communicate with another over a distance was as fast as a single horse could run with the Pony Express. But then we got telegraphs and telephones, and now we've reached the stage in which something like a third or a half of the human race is connected to each other at roughly the speed of light. It is a remarkable event that's happened here at the beginning of the 21st century, and it allows us to collaborate and to work with other people all around the world. I mean, we're doing a podcast and we're 1,500 miles apart. I run an online news and commentary site called The Stream, in which we have staff all over the country, and I do it for my pajamas from my house in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. All of these are new ways of collaborating. And so people that learn to be able to work with others and to be able to learn from others, I would argue people that do that are going to have an edge up in the new economy. So if you think about robots as replacing everything, no, actually those human skills that allow you to work with people and to magnify and improve the work of other people, that is going to be especially valuable in an economy in which machines do more and more of the things that we were previously doing.
Well, and collaboration takes a lot of different forms now. Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, mm-hmm. they're collaborating with homeowners, car owners, and the public in a way that creates something that didn't even exist a few years ago.
No, that's right. I mean, who would have ever, if you think about it, the reason the taxi industry had to essentially be municipal monopolies. I mean, if you show up in a town, a strange town, you don't know anyone, you don't want to get in a car with a stranger. And so you need to be able to tell that's a taxi. It's officially authorized. You know, they've got a record of this guy. And so I feel comfortable getting in this car and not worrying about it being a local axe murderer. Uber and Lyft and these rideshare services, they solved that information problem with what's called a digital trust architecture, so that the Uber driver's connected to the network, they're connected to the map, there's a background check on them, the customer who's getting in their car has their information. And so in many ways, I mean, we let our 15-year-old daughter use Uber sometimes in Washington, D.C. That's an amazing thing, to be able to create a system in which people can get in cars with other strangers and connect them to each other so that a person needing a ride, the person giving a ride, can actually be able to do that. And to do it in a very decentralized way that's not heavily regulated as a monopoly. It's a confluence of factors that gives us a new way to cooperate and collaborate that we could never have done without the technology.
Well, the creativity that's possible and evident today is amazing, because you start connecting things that you wouldn't have thought of before. But when we start to think of artificial intelligence, there's yeah. another dimension and another level, and it comes up a lot in places that I don't really expect it. In the Wall Street Journal this week, there was an mm-hmm. article on the decreased portion of earnings to middle and lower level workers. But it ends mm-hmm. with the question of, what are we going to do with the loss of jobs to robots? And then you've got yeah. Bill Gates and Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and many others saying, we should have this concern. But on the other hand, even Daniel Dennett, one of the four horsemen of the new atheism, he agrees with this sense that if we're asking, are computers going to have consciousness, he thinks we're asking the wrong question. And so what's the right question? How do we think about artificial intelligence, creativity, loss of jobs, robots? I'll just be quiet, because the list just keeps going.
That's a bunch of questions in there. Yeah. But I think that the sort of short answer is, one, distinguish between soft and strong artificial intelligence, or weak and strong artificial intelligence. Strong artificial intelligence is the idea that the robots are going to wake up, the computers are going to become conscious, they're going to take over the world. And there's just absolutely no reason to believe that the machines that we make, they're not anything like us. There's no reason to believe, any more reason to believe, that a computer is going to become conscious than that a tractor is going to become conscious, or that if you build a strong enough tractor, it will become an ox. I mean, it just doesn't follow. On the other hand, we are going to have to deal with the problem of disruption. There are many things we are now doing that will be done and done better by machine. Now, that's the story of human history. All of economic history is about us building machines that do things better. It's just that now they'll be doing things that we thought only humans could do. And yes, there are types of manual labor jobs that are going to become obsolete. But as I argue in the book, there are other kinds that are not. And so what very often we're thinking about the loss of jobs, what we're thinking of is repetitive factory jobs in an assembly line environment. Those jobs are almost all going to go away. And the reason is that they're very easily automated. It's important to remember, though, that those jobs only existed in the 20th century. There have only been factories, centralized factories, for maybe 300 years. But the assembly line was actually invented by Henry Ford in the early 20th century. So don't treat the factory, as we now conceive of it, as some kind of eternal verity that humans have always had to have. It's a particular type of work that is probably an artifact of the 20th century, and it will be disappearing. But there are other kinds of work, the skilled trades, for instance, in which you have to develop a skill and a know-how as a welder or as a carpenter or as a sculptor. Machines aren't going to be doing that kind of stuff anytime soon. In fact, we don't have robots that, you know, we don't have Rosie, the robot, like they have in the Jetsons, that could actually do housework because it involves complex bodily movement, and that's a really tough problem to solve. And so what really people should be thinking of is, okay, types of jobs that are likely to go the way of the dodo bird is both mental and physical jobs that are highly routine and repetitive and that can be reduced to kind of machine learning or to some kind of routine activities. The types of jobs that are not going to go the way of the dodo bird are both manual and mental jobs that involve, as you've said several times, creativity, but also complex bodily know-how and movement. So if you're doing landscaping, we're not going to have landscaping robots anytime soon. It's just not something to worry about. On the other hand, if you are full-time as an Uber driver, you should probably worry about the day in which automated cars take over for you, because that's already starting to happen. And so even though I think, say, the gig economy and jobs like Uber and Lyft are great, I think they are temporary. I do think a lot of the jobs that people do, including lots of men doing long-haul trucking, I think that's likely to be automated. There will be other jobs that will come and replace those. We don't quite know what those are. And so my advice for people is to always be adaptable, always be thinking about the new skills and things that you can develop so that if your particular way of working becomes obsolete, you'll be able to pivot to do something else.
Sure. You talked about Peter Thiel's comment that we can go from one to infinity with an idea. But then you wrote that sometimes we, meaning humans, imagine an idea that takes us from zero to one. That's what sets
us
apart.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Peter Thiel's metaphor. His book is called Zero to One. And his point is that businesses and entrepreneurs can often sort of tweak ideas that somebody has already developed. That's the one to N. You know, it's taking something that already exists and improving it in some way. But every so often we go from zero, from nothing, to one, to something. Now, we don't do that as God does it, obviously. God, as Thomas Aquinas said, is the only one that can create in the proper sense. In other words, he can give being to new things that did not exist before. On the other hand, God creates things and then he leaves it to us to transform it in certain ways. So God creates sand, but he didn't create fiber optic cables and computer chips directly. He gave us the capacity to take sand, to take silica, and to transform these material substrates into technologies that do other things. That's, in a sense, our way of going from zero to one, creating fundamentally new things based upon the physical universe that God has created. And if you believe human beings are created in the image of the creative God, you're going to look for new ways of doing that. You're going to be optimistic about the possibility of doing that in the future, just as we have in the past. If, on the other hand, you just think we're a machine made of meat, that humans are the product of a totally blind evolutionary process that eventually became conscious, then you'll probably think, well, there's no reason we can't design a machine that can do that even better. And so in many ways, this whole debate about man and machine, about artificial intelligence, it comes down to kind of a metaphysical or a theological question about how do you understand the human person? Are we these three agents, unique hybrids of the spiritual and the material created in the image of the creative God? Or are we really just machines made of matter? And depending on where you come down on that fundamental question, you're going to end up with a different view of the future and of the economy and of technology.
Well, one of the quotes you pulled out in the book was from the Wall Street Journal. It said, "Exponential feedback between technology and intelligence is humanity's accelerator." And then you wrote, to miss this is to miss the key fact of our economy. Grasp this and you have reason for hope.
That's exactly right, because we tend to think of all this technology as replacing what we're doing. Well, yes, it might replace or make obsolete an old way of doing what we're doing. But, just, you know, to use the Seegers and Fitness Blender again, maybe there's probably fewer people will need private physical trainers. On the other hand, because they could actually get a lot of the information and training online. On the other hand, millions of people that could never afford private personal trainers now are able to get it effectively free online. That's because of the technology, because of the video technology and the internet and online streaming video technology that allows that to happen. So rather than thinking of technology as replacing us, think of it as a sort of our extension in time and space. It's like our entrepreneurial prostheses, which extend ourselves and our creativity into different domains. So the technology, yes, it can be a bad thing. Every technology has a cost as well as a benefit. But we need to think of these things as enhancing our capacities to do things in new and different ways. If we think of that way, I think we're going to be much more likely to find solutions. If you just think, there's really nothing that I can do and it's all very depressing, you're not going to exercise the courage and the types of virtues you actually need to be able to flourish in the new economy.
Sure. Well, Jay, we're getting close to the end of our program, and we've covered a lot of ground. I mean, you know, from Genesis to AI, that I think that's a pretty long journey, and a little virtue mixed in too. But you've thought a lot about this, and probably since you wrote the book, you thought, gosh, now I've got this new insight. Is there anything else anywhere in the range of the biblical vision for work to the human advantage and how we live with artificial intelligence? Anything else that you might like for our listeners to know from your own reflection?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I was going to boil all this down into a single piece of advice, it would be this: prepare. Don't panic. Yes, there's going to be disruption. Things are changing, and they're changing very quickly. They're, in some ways, they're changing more quickly than they ever have. That is both a cost, and it's something maybe to be concerned about, but it's also a huge opportunity. If you're a student or you have kids that are maybe in high school and college, get them thinking about continuous education in which they're constantly learning new skills and developing new capacities and cultivating new virtues. And if they do that, I'm convinced there are going to be far more opportunities in the future. There will be hundreds of things that we will be able to do in the future. If you think about it, the average American at the time of the American founding, basically they had one option. They could be farmers or work connected to farming, and if they couldn't do that, they didn't have a lot of opportunities to do other things. All of us, if we just have a kind of middling education and a little bit of motivation and can cultivate these virtues, I think in the future have dozens or scores or maybe even hundreds of things that we could do, and it will be a matter of deciding, okay, what's the thing that I could maybe be happy doing and do well, and that would allow me to create value for others and allow me to succeed as well. So prepare, get ready for massive change, but don't panic that the machines are going to take over.
Sure. Yeah, we haven't really talked about education that much, but the key things there are what? Adaptability, what base knowledge should someone try to have, and how do they prepare to be adaptable?
That's exactly right. And for college students, I really advise students, do everything you can to get a good solid base in liberal arts education and critical thinking to enrich your soul. That's the purpose of a liberal arts education. And also develop some side technical specialties, whether it's social media or it's accounting or whatever it is. So don't just do one or the other. Don't hyper-specialize, but also don't hyper-generalize. If you can and you can afford it, try to get a good liberal arts grounding and then also develop some particular technical skill that will allow you to survive.
Jay, I'd love to just keep talking. It's great fun. I've really enjoyed our time together, and I appreciate your book. I really want to recommend it to our audience. The book is called The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. And as Jay just said, we need to prepare for the future, but don't panic. God is with us. Jesus said, do not fear, and he gave us a lot of capacities to do the things that he's called us to do. So, Jay Richards, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great to be with you, Larry.
Bless you. You take care. Thank you to our audience for being with us today. I hope you'll visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to listen to our previous programs and also as podcast at Hill Country Institute Live. We have audio and video from past conferences on faith and culture issues, such as work, science, and art, and topics of concern such as environmental stewardship and fighting human trafficking. We ask for your financial support for this program so we may pay the radio stations and continue to be on the air. You can donate at our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, and by calling 512-680-7993. That's 512-680-7993 and hillcountryinstitute.org. For donations of $100 or more, we have Jay Richards' book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines, or a selection of books on faith and culture. Thank you again for being with us for Hill Country Institute Live. We encourage you to share the love and wisdom of Jesus Christ wherever God calls you.